on today's episode of the Law of Tech podcast.
I don't think we give ourselves enough credit either, because, you know, this profession has been going on for a very, very long time. And the fact that we are remained as a profession relatively stable and relatively safe, like, that's a skill in itself. You know, people, sectors come and go, and somehow, and again, I know that people can mock this, let them, but in a way, you know, there is a strength in it, right? There is a strength in it, and there is a strength in protecting the profession, whether it's for the better or for the worse. I'm not passing judgment at this point in time, or whether it's to our advantage or disadvantage in the long run. But there's a certain resilience, there's a certain, you know, a certain level of intelligence when it comes to understanding legal principles. So it's not all bad. And I think that there is a tendency to strictly polarize. It's either, you know, oh, we're all saints and we're all wonderful, or we're all bad and we never learn and we hate change. Like, it's a human thing.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Law of Tech podcast. My name is Hadassah Drukash. I'm your host, and I am joined by my co-host, Marco Mendola.
Hello, everyone. Nice to be here.
It's great to be back, and we will be talking about a very interesting topic, answering the question, what legal innovation exactly entails, thereby understanding change in the legal sector between transformation and disruption, with Alexandra Vazhushchuk. Now, Alexandra heads LawTech UK, a government-backed program transforming the UK legal ecosystem through technology. After implementing digital innovation in regulated industry, she now drives projects ranging from advancing tech adoption in the legal sector to promoting English law for the digital economy. Alexandra maintains an active academic practice as well as being a member of the City of London's LawTech Sounding Board. Alexandra, that is quite a track record, I have to say,
in a mouthful. I'm beginning to regret sending you that bio. It looks much better on paper.
No, not at all.
It's too late. We say it out loud.
It's done. It's done. Unless it didn't record, of course, in which case, you know, I'm just going to make sure it's done again.
No, it is absolutely perfect. Welcome. We're really happy to have you. Now, to kick off the episode, we have provided you with an article focusing on the shift between law and technology to law plus technology. Now, we know that you've read the article and we're looking forward to some discussion on it, focusing on the topic of legal innovations. Maybe to start off, do you want to share some thoughts on the paper and kind of like link it to the topic of legal innovation?
I love Marco's face right now, considering the discussion we just had 5 minutes ago, and now he's looking at me like, go.
Yes. I really want to hear from you, Alex. Absolutely, yes. So
look, I must say that I struggled with this paper. I have to say, I struggled with this paper, and I don't know if I struggled with it because I come from a more legal theory background. So when I see, you know, references to rules and standards, for example, when I see references to HART, there is something in me that automatically thinks about the tradition that they come from and how easily it is to just start, you know, flagging them with a single footnote, but without necessarily going into the meat of the arguments or the meat of a tradition where they come from. So, you know, it's been hard from that perspective. But casting that aside, I think I was once told by my undergrad mentor that one of my papers was very, very good, but it was very ideas rich. And I think that's what this paper may be struggling with, that it tries to pack so much in so little space. But Marco's raising his hand. Nodding. Just a note. Marco is nodding. I am not alone.
This is extremely interesting to hear. I love the challenge and the straight interaction. So from what I hear from you, Alexandra, it's not just about semantics here. So the critique is not just about the plus or the end in comparing law and technologies. It's much more. This is a fair statement to say.
I like having strong definitions. I like it when people set out the background. And sometimes, you know, you can have less content overall. But when you're setting an argument, it's nice to take people, handhold them through the journey. And when somebody tells me that law and technology can promote synergies, I really struggle to grasp what they mean by that. So one of the themes that I know you guys wanted to talk about today was about this distinction between, you know, law and tech and law plus tech, which fundamentally is the simple idea that you need to stop antagonizing lawyers against technology, right? So in that respect, it's not that controversial. So in Brussels only last year at the conference, the Athens Roundtable, we were talking about the EU AI Act, and one of the themes that really came across quite strongly was that idea that you really need to educate institutions about technology so they can regulate it more pragmatically.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, for innovation purposes, or if you're thinking about it pragmatically, or what this means in practice, is that you want to be thinking not just about the harm that technology may potentially cause in the future, but also about its benefits and understanding the benefits that it brings to the table.
So something that I read, at least in the article, which may lead us to the topic that we want to talk about today, that which is legal innovation and, you know, the distinction between innovation and disruption. And that is that he mentioned later on in the piece, you know, the possibility of using technology or code to kind of regulate. What I, at least how I saw this in a way, is as a way to use technology, not necessarily for legal service, the provision of legal services, but in a way moving towards that shift of like, okay, so you have the, you know, possibility to regulate technology itself without there being a direct link between tech and law. But you also have the possibility to use technology to regulate technology, for instance. So that's where, like, where this idea came into mind to talk about legal innovation. Like, okay, so how does this work in the legal innovation space where we're using technology to provide legal services? So we really see like this interaction between the two.
So one thing you need to remember is that legal regulators don't really regulate tech, they regulate people. So we would be talking about different types of regulation in legal. But what I would also add to this, and I have to give a shout out to a wonderful woman, Professor Sarah Losky, who is working on in computational law, and they're trying to code the tax law in the US. So they developed a new programming language called Catala. It's pretty cool what they're trying to achieve. And that's a completely separate, again, we need to distinguish that effort from the regulatory effort. I think attempts to do similar, so turn law algorithmic, have been made in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the way they differ from what Sarah Losky's team is trying to do, and I'm sure she would say, oh, it's not just me, it's my entire team. But but I spoke with Professor Losky, so I'm going to refer to her team as her. Apologies. All right. What she is doing, or they were doing, is based on pair programming. So they're bringing lawyers and coders together,
mm-hmm.
which means that the two worlds kind of collide and they learn from each other. And you're not expecting a lawyer to be an expert coder. You're not expecting a coder to be an expert lawyer. You have the two worlds. They need to have a certain base level of knowledge to be able to come to understand each other. And what that is really, more than just the project itself, what that really shows is that we can work together with, mm-hmm. and if we come together with people from technology, with people from, I don't know, engineering, things can really change and things can really progress in a better direction. So whether the project is successful or novel is almost immaterial for our purposes right now, I think, because when we focus on a bigger picture, this is such a great example of being able to collaborate between disciplines.
Exactly. Now, moving to legal innovation or, you know, the innovation of legal services through technologies. How is this something? Because that essentially is what I, at least as we mentioned before we started recording this episode, and I think also Mark already said during this episode, you know, this ability to collaborate, to bring both together is something that at least struck me from this paper.
I confess. Yeah, same myself. Sorry if I jump in, because I've, you know, in the last 15 years working in different jurisdictions as, lawyer, then trainee lawyer again. And so every time I was in the firm, every time from lawyers, so just people doing, you know, practicing law every day, so nothing about academics or researchers, they always see that as a fight, this technology, we need to protect ourselves, we need to protect the client, we need to protect the risks, we need to do risk management. So from a really practical base level perspective, I think that I fall in a trap of like, oh, wow, this is not a fight anymore. And to read that into a piece of paper was kind of like, yeah, it was kind of a shock.
Just to ask you, just to poke you a little bit on this, why do you think there is that fight?
Or
what do you perceive as a fight?
I perceive it as a fight, I think, because of risk management. This is what I've learned of being very conservative in the way you are providing legal advice when technology is involved, because it's something like a hot potato that you struggle to handle. So this is, let's say, a kind of general principle, a general approach that I've learned in practicing law when technology is involved. Don't get into the definitions of technologies, because we're lawyers and we don't need to understand them. Do not challenge the technology, because that's not our job. And most importantly, we are not required to be experts or to better understand technology, because, again, we focus on the law itself. So this is why, this is the, let's say, the environment I don't think just myself, because I had tons of, you know, discussions with other friends and people that are lawyers for real, not like me, because right now mine is more like
we're just pretending, it's fine.
Mine is like a hybrid, definitely not a traditional lawyer.
And are you a non-lawyer? Like I'm a non-accountant.
Yes,
non-doctor.
Yes, so I'm very, very firm on this. I mean, this is my experience, and the experience I've shared with many friends and colleagues around my age, let's say. That's my answer so far. That's why, you know,
I can one up you. Do you want me to one up you?
Please do it.
I don't think it's about lawyers not understanding or not wanting to. I don't know. We can have an opinion whether it's an educational point or whether it's a generational point or if it's, you know, just general fear of change. I don't know. There are many explanations for it, but it's a universal, it's an almost universal problem that I think we're struggling with, and not just as a legal profession. I think almost all of professional services are struggling with it. There is no or very limited conversation between engineers and professionals in professional services, which means that we don't have that voice of reason which would tell us, oh, this is actually possible, or you're talking complete nonsense. So we go on those tangents where we build those, you know, extreme risk policies in our heads when we go, oh, but this may happen. And we don't have the cap of an engineer saying the chances of that happening are zero.
I'm just curious to know why. Like, because like you just mentioned, like, you know, it is possible for both to collaborate. There is a possibility for both to understand each other. So what's the deal?
That's a very difficult question, and I don't think many people have very good answers for it.
Do you have thoughts on it?
I
not the answer, maybe, but thoughts.
I'm not sure if it's because we're just not mixing enough. I mean, we need to get out more, you know. Or maybe it's because the two groups speak completely different languages very frequently. So it's very convenient and very comfortable to kind of settle in the legal sector, or, you know, financial services does the same thing, right? Any sector has their own language, you know, and their own lingo, their own habits, their own, you know, I don't want to play sociologist by any stretch of imagination. But it seems to me, you know, commonsensically, that you grow into this web, and you forget that you actually do require quite a lot of external reference.
Mm-hmm.
But because you feel, and when you're building legal expertise, it's so easy to just disappear down the rabbit hole of legal expertise, that admitting that you're not good at something else would almost go to the core of your identity. And I don't think it's specific to lawyers. I think it's just human nature that, you know, once you're an expert, it's very difficult to admit that you may not be an expert in everything, and actually you can be pretty hopeless in a lot of things.
My question to you, I want to know from your experience, Alexandra, if broadly researchers and engineers, they're more flexible and open-minded to constructive change or feedback or even critique than lawyers, or not?
I don't know. I think a lot of it depends on an individual, you know.
I think so too.
A lot of this is just what kind of, and of course we can have this conversation about, you know, what kind of personalities are being attracted to certain professions, and that's fair play too.
Sure.
But I mean, I've been reasonably lucky to keep company with very open-minded people. I've been reasonably lucky to have a very diverse group of friends. I've been reasonably lucky to have people call me out very early on any early attempts to be self-righteous. And
good.
It was exactly. And it's honestly the best thing that can happen to you is to have friends who will keep you humble and friends who will tell you, well, what is it that you're doing up there in your law school? Because it actually happened to me. There was a social scientist who told me that, oh, none of what you do, guys, is like, we just laugh at you because none of this has any scientific merit. And I'm like, you just attacked my entire being. And then he said, well, you're not stating your methodology, you're not stating a paradigm, you're not like, and all, he started listing all those things that really matter in social sciences. And it was such a eureka moment. And when it happens to you, and then you start reading and you start engaging with others, and you get to this point when you're like, I want to tell everybody that there is another world behind this door that we're all too scared to open. So it's all very, I think it's all very individual. I don't know. What do you guys think?
No, I would agree. And I also think it's vice versa. You know, like it's one, I think it's maybe too harsh to just look at the, you know, the side of the lawyers or the legal minds, because on the other side, we also have an argument to make towards those that disagree with us. So you can say, like, from an engineer's perspective, what we may be talking about, what we may be doing makes no sense, but vice versa also. So I don't think it should be a barrier towards collaborating. I think that really is something that's at a personal level or at a human level. The fact that we like to stick to what we know, that we like to create a wall of trust, you could say, of understanding, like, okay, I've done this and I understand what I'm doing and that's it. Like, exploring into the deep and unknown seems extremely scary for both parties, I think, or for all parties that are not the same. So I mean, think that it's, yeah.
So many different books written on persuasion. I think, was it Cialdini's book? I think it's somewhere on my bookshelf, on influence and persuasion. Mm-hmm. And you kind of, it's such a human universal. And actually what you said about lawyers to just even out the balance, I don't think we give ourselves enough credit either, because, you know, this profession has been going on for a very, very long time. And the fact that we are remained as a profession relatively stable and relatively safe, like that's a skill in itself. You know, people, sectors come and go. And somehow, and again, I know that people can mock this, let them. But in a way, you know, there is a strength in it, right? There is a strength in it. And there is a mm-hmm. strength in protecting the profession, whether it's for the better or for the worse. Mm-hmm. I'm not passing judgment at this point in time. Or whether it's to our advantage or disadvantage in the long run. But yeah. there's a certain resilience. There's a certain, you know, a certain level of intelligence. When it comes to understanding legal mm-hmm. principles. So it's not all bad. And I think that there is a tendency to strictly polarize. It's either, you know, oh, we're all saints and we're all wonderful, or we're all bad and we never yeah. learn and we hate change. Like, it's a human thing.
That, however, I would say, doesn't mean that, kind of moving back to the point of collaboration, that there is no space to collaborate. How do you see this collaboration manifest itself in practice?
So that's an interesting question. And again, this is not something that is easily resolved. I recently spoke with, what's the best way to anonymize this? Let's say a VC investor. And we were talking about the profiles of different founders in different sectors. And one of his points was that the legal sector is very special because a lot of the startup founders are lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we started looking into it, I mean, some of the most successful ones are set up by different people from different professions, but on average, a lot of them are lawyers. This doesn't happen in, for example, insurtech or fintech. Uber was not set up by a taxi driver.
I understand now. Yeah, yeah.
So it's a very, again, it's a very special market for this kind of thing. But in legal services, I mean, technically lawyers collaborate all the time with others, right? So if you're on an M&A transaction, You have to work together with your clients who are not going to be lawyers. I mean, you're going to be working with in-house counsel frequently, but it's not just the in-house counsel. So it's not like we can't think of any examples where lawyers have to collaborate with members of other professions or other professionals. But simultaneously, on the theme of collaboration, you know, what we've seen, and I think where the biggest change is coming, is when you see collaboration, for example, between regulators, when you see, you know, in the LawTech UK sandbox, there are a few examples where LawTechs would ask questions about the regulatory challenges, and they would work through them with the help of the regulators who were collaborating together. So if you had a question for example, you know, that would impact three different remits or three different regulatory frameworks, you could get the regulators effectively together to agree on the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where the magic happens. So it's not just about collaborating. And I think this will be the future. Collaborating between professionals will be eventually the future, because now you already have this growth of roles that don't fit the traditional confines of just delivery of legal services. You have, you know, change people, you have legal ops people, you have all sorts of folk who will need to collaborate between each other. So I don't really think that we can escape it. I don't think we can somehow go back to this idea of sitting in an ivory tower and just writing a very long legal opinion in isolation.
But at the same time, do you think this is something that will happen naturally then? Or is there more necessary to get this collaboration or to, you know, to realize this type of collaboration?
I think what would be very interesting to see is how the clients' expectations change and how that impacts things.
Mm-hmm.
Because when a client expects, especially in recession, right, when you're cutting costs, I would imagine client expectations regarding billing, for example, will shift.
Yeah, will change,
and the budgets would tighten.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a very clear scope there for developing something together with, you know, between a client and a provider. So that would be the easiest example of, because you always need to have an incentive, right? There is no way anything is going to happen without a commercial or other incentive. So the incentive of trying to keep the client happy would, or keep the margins, or for the incentive for the client to keep their budgets at the level that they're comfortable with, will have to funnel some in, or turn into some kind of a collaborative solution.
Mm-hmm.
So I think crises are generally conducive of collaboration. But I don't know. I don't know what's going to be. Maybe tech is going to be the catalyst too, you know.
Because I was going to ask you, like, how does technology play a role in this?
Because if you think about it, as the legal roles, let's just call them legal roles, as they develop and shift, and as less time is spent on just doing research and more time is perhaps spent on, you know, relationship building or more expert legal advice, right? So, or working together with different advisors of a client, that will naturally have to shift. So if you offload a lot of the admin work, which is already happening, that's not, you know, that's yesterday's news.
Mm-hmm.
If you start offloading that part that is typically performed by yourself at your desk or your desktop, then automatically it's going to force you to interact more with others. And I appreciate that the counterpoint to this may be, oh, but, you know, if you have a lot of tech available, then why would you need to collaborate with others? Because you can just send them a template that's, you know, calculate, your machine is going to calculate risks for you. So you're going to know if we're going to contest that clause or not. And you're going to agree your predefined risk profiles and whatever. But that, in a way, is still collaboration. It's not just two people sitting by themselves and not talking to each other.
No, true. That's definitely true. All I'm wondering is, like, with all this technology that's coming into play, right? So it takes away a lot of the basic tasks that are done by, for instance, lawyers. But I imagine, like, if we look at a ChatGPT, and I think that's something that, you know, a whole separate episode could be dedicated to like, just talk about that right now. But you see, like, this, you know, these systems are getting more advanced. They're capable of much more than they were initially. So I'm just curious to know, like, how, you know, what the role, for instance, a lawyer would look like in the future, when it seems, at least, but that's like just a total guess at this point, that the role of them as a traditional lawyer is becoming less and less, and it's focusing more on building connections, which isn't necessarily the only thing that characterizes a lawyer, right? So I'm just wondering, like, the more these systems are able to do, the less a lawyer is a lawyer. Like, between who is this collaboration then at the end of the day?
I think I have three potential points that may lead us in the right direction. So one is whether we're going to need to abandon the word lawyer altogether.
Because what does it still mean when we have these technologies in place that really question the bare basics of what a lawyer is?
I mean, the answer to that is going to be whether we're talking about technology performing reserved activities. And I know that at this point in mm-hmm. time, this is a very touchy subject and
yeah.
unlikely to happen in 2023 for various reasons. So if we take that out of the equation,
yeah,
that was still going to be, there is still going to be legal work to be done.
Yes, certainly.
I don't think that that's necessarily going to go away. Lawyers had to, or at least good lawyers, have had to provide business sound advice for quite a long time now. So at least the last decade, I mean, even when I was in law school, I would be told that, you know, commercial awareness was a big yeah. deal. And I would be told to read the front page of DFT. And I was like, what even is mm-hmm. derivatives market? But it doesn't matter. Just throw it out there. And all the senior lawyers working in derivatives market would yeah. just look at you like, oh, bless you, child. But it was a big deal then, and I think it's an yeah. even bigger deal now. And especially if you work in-house, you're expected to be a... And there is a discussion, again, this is not... I don't want to present it as a given, because there is very much a discussion happening around the changing role of in-house legal. But overall, in-house is going to be... has been, you know, from my experience working at an in-house legal team, a legal counsel is still, especially a GC, is expected to be very commercially savvy, know the business inside out, and advise almost on strategy rather than just with the use of law, rather than just deliver purely legal advice. So that aspect of it is changing almost entirely. And then mm-hmm. Without droning on about it too much, then you also have this issue of new roles evolving, which have absolutely nothing to do with reserve activities. So it's things like ops, like change, like project management. Do they need lawyers? Well, there is an argument that they do because, oh, you don't understand how law firms work, or you don't understand how legal matters work. And that may have some merit, but I prefer the argument that you actually need skills that are completely sector agnostic. Because you can learn how the sector works, or you can learn how the business works. And it's, shocking, not that complicated when you think about it. But you desperately need people who possess those sector agnostic skills. And by sector agnostic, I mean skills that are not typical or reserved to any profession in particular. So project management, change management, mm-hmm. communication skills, business management, you know, all those things. Somebody told me once, I think it was at Legal Geek last year, that it's not the robots that are going to steal our jobs, it will be the MBAs. Mm-hmm. And there is some truth to it, you know, because those sector agnostic skills are going to be a priced goods. It's just that most of the people outside of the legal sector, I don't think they've seen this opportunity yet.
It's almost ironic.
This is, I mean, it's a good point. And I very much welcome a future like that for the diversity of the entire movement, honestly.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's just the diversity part. You know, you just need, in order for the profession to survive for another century, or maybe not survive, but evolve, you will need a lot of diversity of thought, diversity of backgrounds. There is no other way about it.
That's, I think, the point, right? Like evolving or reestablishing itself. Because I think it's easy to look at, for instance, the MBA sphere to be like the future of the legal profession and these, you know, additional skills. But it's a profession that, as you said just before, Alexandra, you know, it has been around for a long time. And I think that these, perhaps with some experience as annoying barriers, like taking the bar and being qualified in whatever way you want to describe that, is what keeps it alive also. Because otherwise everyone could be calling themselves a lawyer. Everyone could, you know, be part of the legal profession. Now, I'm not saying that you know, they shouldn't, but I do think it's a way to keep it alive, right?
It's interesting. There's an entire Instagram that I'll send you a link to a book after. There's an entire book on how professions evolve and what purpose regulation serves in the entire journey of, you know, how professional bodies or professional membership bodies evolve and how they get built and how it's effectively about protecting the interests of the members of a given profession. So while I completely appreciate what you're saying, and it's a very pertinent issue that there are some very good arguments to be made for the benefits that being a profession brings to the members of this profession.
Mm-hmm.
I still believe that it also can become a caricature in itself if we're not being careful. So someone, again, I wish I could, I'm just going to start noting people down. I think I'm getting old. I think that's what it is. I keep like losing people.
That's too early. Don't let me feel, otherwise I'm the oldest here, so don't let me feel.
We're all going to break it out in tears. Okay. But somebody said to me that it really is about, with the legal sector, it really fundamentally is about shifting the mindset from what happens if you have a contractual breach and how we can better respond or better manage contractual breaches versus how do we ensure that people keep their promises? And that's ultimately, when I heard this, I was like, another eureka moment. You know, you think about it, we've built an entire language around it that can be so inaccessible, especially when it's in consumer services. So we can talk about business to business all day long, but when you're thinking about consumer services, there is a high risk that by protecting ourselves, we've built an entire kingdom around ourselves that can be impenetrable and perhaps go even against the best interest of the people who should be benefiting from the services. And I'm not saying that that's true. It's just one of the arguments that is perhaps worth considering when we think about our own future as a profession.
Now, you mentioned Law Tech UK just before. Can you tell us a little bit more about Law Tech UK, what you're doing, kind of bringing what we've been talking about to what you're doing in practice? Can you tell us a little bit more?
Sure. So Law Tech UK is a government-backed initiative that aims to transform the legal services through technology and digital innovation for the benefit of the economy and the society.
Very good.
In practice, we're running several different programs. So some of the stuff that we were talking about earlier, especially to do with A2J, you know, we're running one of the projects right now is specifically targeting that space. So during the event in, I think, November, that one of the panels at the Law Tech UK event talked about the barriers to access to justice and how more needed to be done about it. So what Law Tech UK is doing at the moment is it's working on a solution or start targeting or start to get this conversation going about how those barriers can be tackled. But it's very much in progress. So watch this space. There's another piece of work that we're doing around AI adoption. So again, Marco may know my views on a lot of discussions that are happening around AI and ML.
Of course, yes, but I won't share the secrets.
Which means the more we simplify the landscape, the better. And the more we invite engineers and developers to the table, the better. But we try to demystify, so Law Tech UK is trying to demystify this landscape together with the Regulatory Response Unit, which is kind of a bunch of regulators put together in a single fast response forum. That typically, you know, they perform different functions, but one of the projects that we're running with them is the adoption of AI piece. We run a discussion paper, so we're collecting responses from the market for a period. We're now looking at those responses and collating some guidance on good principles when adopting AI, and we're learning from the sector around how different organizations of different profiles are dealing with technology. And another paper that's coming out this week is for all the fans of digital assets out there, very much in the English law being the asset for digital economy space. We are looking at digital securities and how English law supports digital securities. There is a legal statement. The group is that's wrote the statement is called UK Jurisdiction Task Force. It's chaired by Master of the Rolls. And we've also commissioned some research to be done by Auxera. So watch this space. Oh, did I mention the accelerator? Well, we're also running an accelerator for startups, and it's an accelerator. It's like a mentoring program for startups and scale-ups working in this space of legal technology. This year we had, or the past year, we had over 30 or 40, I can't remember off the top of my head, startups and scale-ups who participated. And it's been a wild ride. But it's great to see how many amazing ideas people have, how they go. After years, it was the third edition, yeah. I believe. So you see those founders progress and achieve some reasonable success. So, yeah, very excited for the future.
It's great to hear directly from you, Alexandra, because I've been a follower, fan of Law Tech UK since I have, last 3 years at least. But every time, it sounds that behind the scene, there's always much, much, much more. And I've always wanted to know more. So this is also the reason why you're here today. I really wanted to know more about your project. But
that's a very roundabout way of asking for this, Marco. I mean, we could have had just like the 5-minute conversation and indeed. Then we call it a day.
Yeah, but I definitely remember. But last time at Legal Geek, we spoke about coffees. So, I mean, I blew up my chance. But because as I said, being conscious also of your time, because you have been very, very kind to join us tonight. Let's conclude the discussion with a little tradition that we have set up. In our previous episode one, we had Nikki Shaver, and we discussed with Nikki about framing the problem, so falling in love with the problem, not jumping into the solution. And we ask her, can you please craft a couple of questions to the next guest? So I want to quote the question, so I don't want to rephrase myself, because I want to stick to what Nikki said, okay? And then obviously you can answer, or if you don't want to answer, you can share your thoughts. How does it sound?
Yes, that sounds great.
So let's start. So how do you think legal innovation differs between a law firm environment and a corporate legal environment? I appreciate the question is very broad, but if you can give us a couple of thoughts.
One basic difference, incentives. Why is it that you innovate? If you're a law firm, what is your incentive to revisit your business model that has served you well for, or, you know, some would say that it served you kind of well, but, well for a number of years. For a legal corporate department, it would be, what is your incentive for supporting the corporate strategy of your internal client? What is your incentive to drive the best value for the board? And what is your incentive to drive the business forward? And these are fundamentally two different questions. Because when you're playing around with, changing an entire delivery model for legal services with the structure that an average big law firm operates on, that is very difficult. I mean, to convince everybody in partnership that, this thing that I'm proposing may actually work, that's hard work, So, which is why innovation in law firms takes a slightly, perhaps, different shape, right? But if you think about corporate legal departments, if you're basically a business advisor, then you have to think about, and you have very limited resources, you have typically limited budgets, you have limited time in a day. You don't operate on a billable hour. You're salaried. When you think about all of those confines, and if you think about how you want to provide the best value for your internal clients, then you're thinking about the way that your team operates, not how your entire company operates. And you're not trying to upend the table on effectively years and years and years of tradition. So it may be easier and maybe harder for depending on, you know, individual circumstances, but I think if we're generalizing, those would probably be the key differences.
Maybe also linking to that, that's actually also the second question that Nikki had, is like, what do you believe is the role of legal operations in delivering innovation within corporate legal departments?
So what's interesting about this question to me is that I suspect that a lot of, before legal ops became a thing in the UK, I mean, not talking about legal ops in the US, it's a completely different story. But thinking about the UK, how many in-house lawyers have been performing legal operation functions without calling it legal operations for the last decade? I mean, when I joined...
Everyone, maybe?
Exactly, right? It's just, it's not officially in your job description, or it is, but it's like, you know, managing work. Nobody used to say you're managing workflows or I don't know, intake of, or whatever it is. People just used to say you run the legal function, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about it and you think about how the processes have been set up, it kind of grew out organically from what lawyers were doing to what lawyers were starting to do to make their job easier because, again, of the pace that you work at in-house and different expectations, yada, yada. We can talk about it all day. And the fact that legal ops crystallized as this separate function is going to be helpful in the long run, I think, for the legal departments because you can offload a lot of this work to people who can be trained and skilled specifically in this area rather than you trying to upskill yourself while simultaneously giving legal advice. So in that sense, I think legal ops will be impactful. I just don't know whether it's going to be a permanent function yet. I don't know if it's going to be more of a contractor function where you come to set up a system or if it's going to be more of a, you know, permanent function for that's going to turn more administrative. So you're going to be thinking about reporting and maybe combined with like risk assessment. So I don't know. I don't know how legal ops are going to evolve in themselves. Whether it's going to become its own thing, like it does in the, it has in the US, or whether because of all the cuts that are happening in the US, in-house legal teams in the UK are going to start looking at it more, you know, we're happy to have some help, but it may not be a permanent thing that grows on top of a legal team.
Really wrapping up this episode, we want to ask you if you have any questions or a question to keep the guess what going to our next episode to the guest of our next episode. In the next episode we'll be discussing the topic of whether or not we need non-lawyers to basically work together with lawyers to foster legal innovation.
So I think I had a question in mind that I would normally ask, which is if you met a genie and had three wishes, what would you change in the legal profession if it could happen overnight? And that's like, that's a cop-out question in a way, because, you know, you can leave you a lot of discretion.
Yeah.
But I think when you think about non-lawyers, or again, people that do not come from, are not qualified solicitors or barristers performing reserved activities.
Yeah.
Maybe the question, I mean, an additional question could be, what types of professionals would the legal sector benefit from the most? And what types of skills are we missing the most? And can those skills be addressed through education of lawyers, or is there an argument to be made that we need to outsource them to others?
We're taking your questions with us for sure to the next episode, and I'm hoping that we can get some challenging discussion out of that. For now, I think that we'll wrap up the episode. Thank you so much for joining us and for really challenging us throughout the entire episode.
Thank you so much for the invitation, guys. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Law of Tech podcast. If you want to make sure you keep up to date with the show and never miss out on an episode, be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and follow the Law of Tech on social media.
If you enjoyed the show, please give it a rating or review as it helps others discover the show. And don't forget to share it with your network. For now, have a great day, and I'll see you in the next episode of the Law of Tech podcast.